My background originally is in economics, and my interest and passion, my postgraduate work is in behavioural economics, which I think is a title which is as useful as juggler or magician. It doesn't really mean anything. We long for it to be an algorithmic science, and it's not. It's a behavioural science. Behavioural sciences, by their nature, are weak. I think it's incredibly important. I mean, I was excited by it when I first started learning about it in 1982 at the University of Sydney, only a couple of blocks from here. And I think the way in which we apply behaviourism to psychology and behaviourism to economics will change the future of the country. If we do this well or do it poorly, the economic outcomes are substantial. Phenology is Graham's word. It's a portmanteau word. That's what happens when we push two words together which don't fit together. It's not common in English. It's common in Latin, for those of you who studied Latin. It's very common in German. German's an incredibly plastic language. They have words like, which they do, where they push words together frequently, like one of my favourites is Blausenpop, which is the blouse is your shirt, to pop your shirt over your belt buckle so that no one can tell if you're fat or you've just got a loose shirt. The second, the one I speak German fluently. The German word for headlight is not headlight, which is also a portmanteau word, but Scheinwerfer, which means light thrower, which I also think is funny. But my absolute favourite is Backpfeifgesicht, which was invented in 1990 for Justin Bieber when he toured Germany. Remember, he arrived with a monkey, and they wouldn't accept the monkey because the monkey was full of diseases. And Backpfeifgesicht means a face that you see and immediately want to punch. So understanding how this works and what you do is incredibly important. The work that we've been doing for the past decade looks at the effect that advice has on individuals, and the advice, and what happens is that advice is functionally transformative. Douglas pointed some of the points out in what happened at Platinum and the way in which that works, but we are very clearly aware of the effect of advice. And the work we've done in the US for Vanguard, Fidelity in the UK, and locally here for some of the other fund managers shows that the advisor's alpha is give or take about 3% a year. 3% a year better off if you had an advisor. Mostly that's around the denial of purchase and people staying with the investment process longer rather than going away from it. But understanding that is really important. It's not just financial, though. It's all about confidence and the way in which people make decisions. It's the way in which how they feel about the future and what they do and the way in which they work. So understanding that is critically important. My postgraduate work is based on trust and the way in which trust works. Trust is uniquely human. We're the only animal that trusts. We're credulous by design, if you want to think about it that way. And the reason that we are trusting animals is that the prefrontal cortex, which is the cauliflower-shaped aberration on the front bit of our brain appearing on this ventral slice as the blue part of the brain diagram, is unique to us. We're the only animal that passes every thought through that part of our brain, because no other animal has it, and that stores up behaviour. When we get a behaviour where trust occurs, we literally release oxytocin into the bloodstream, so there is an absolutely fundamental chemical bias to the way this works. And it allows us to pay benefit forward, it allows us to hold on to ideas, and it allows us to be constructed. But the problem with that is that we build up patterns and pathways, which become our biases. Now, there's a great debate about whether this is born or whether this is something that we develop over time in the way in which we work. For those of you who have children, you will know that your children are all completely different and are rewarded in different ways, that they face stress differently, that they react to stress differently, that they act very differently. The data seems to be more convincingly that cognitive biases are hardwired and then can be altered only slightly after that, after time. The brain is a complex thing. As we get better and better at producing MRIs, which is magnetic resonance images of the brains in action and putting dye into them and taking photographs of it, we understand where these biases occur. They actually have homes inside the brain. Revenge, clearly, which is a bias which is interestingly geographic. It's not shared equally by all races, and I think we can experience that. It lives in a place of the brain called the amygdala. This is a drawing of the brain which is like a map of Australia where only the states appear. The amygdala is just above the brain stem, which is the kind of lizard part of the brain. It's about the size of an almond, but every time that you experience the benefit of revenge or enact revenge, that fires up like a traffic light. So we know exactly where that is. Revenge isn't uniquely human. This is really interesting, right? Lots of animals have amygdalas, and lots of animals exact revenge on each other. Monkeys do revenge, birds do revenge. The most vengeful animal in the world is a thing called the prairie vole. What's really interesting about the prairie vole, the thing that they enact revenge for, is when animals have illicit affairs, they take other partners. The other male prairie voles will gang up and destroy the male prairie vole, which is sleeping around. The father of cognitive bias is this guy, and anyone who's studying behavioral science tends to revere this guy. This is Carl Jung. Carl Jung wrote a book in 1921 called The Classification, which is about the 21 cognitive biases that he discovered in 1921 and he was talking about, and how people worked inside those classifications. So this is not a new idea. We've all read The General Theory of Money, Interest, and Employment, and chapter 15 is really clear on behavioral economics. It's not the job of the investor to select the best fund, it's the job of the investor to select the fund which most people think is the best fund, because true price isn't reflected. It's affection which is. So Keynes knew all about this, Marcus Aurelius knew all about this, so it's not new. So understanding this is kind of interesting. So the foundation of bias and the way in which bias is talked about occurred at this conference in 1921 in Stanford in America. And if you look at that, that's got the great psychologists in it. It's got an older Sigmund Freud, who's this guy over here, and it's got a very young Karl Marx who's doing his best to look like a German. Carl Jung, who's doing his best to look like a villain in this one. I mean, if I was to draw a Bond supervillain, I'd draw a guy who looked a little bit like that. So understanding bias was driven out of this. There's also this guy here. This guy is called William Reichman. He was the first person to abuse bias and turn this into another science and try and sell it to a bunch of people all around the world. Reichman's famous because he was the person who invented the Orgone Energy Analyzer, which was designed to pick up the unspent male energy in sperm, which is stored in your testes, which was blue in color, and he could harness through using crystals. For those of us who have a history in Australian cars and the demise of Holdeners, Peter Brock had Orgone Energy Analyzers on the top of his cars as he raced around the mountain. He was a fraud. And there's plenty of frauds in this space. Myers-Briggs tests, that we've all done them, right? And we've all subscribed to them. We've all seen the patterns in ourselves in them. Were done by two people, Catherine Myers and Elizabeth Briggs, who weren't psychologists, who weren't studied, but took Jung's classifications, extrapolated it out into 16 categories, because Mrs. Myers saw her daughter marrying someone that she didn't like particularly, so she wanted to set up a system of classification. Yet 2 million people do it a year in Australia. It's as meaningful as the horoscope. So before you start assigning cognitive biases to yourself or starting cognitive biases to other people, there are parts of this which are a reasonably exact science, and understanding it is really important. We all go on this kind of journey to self-awareness. So this kind of road to self-awareness is really interesting, and this is a quote from Jung. Do not mistake your dog's adoration for the fact that you're wonderful, particularly if you're in a position of power inside your organization. And I tell myself this all the time. Everyone's nice to me at Core Data because I own it. People probably, like I've done before me and you've done, dislike their boss quite intensely, but are happy to put up with it. Clients behave differently. And it's really important to understand the way in which clients are constructed. And we're going to get into this in a second and to understand what's going on. But most commonly among Australians particularly is the desire to satisfy the person sitting in front of you. We're hardwired to do that. What's interesting is as you go up the intelligence curve and as you go up the wealth curve, that starts to flex and starts to change. It's a really interesting thing that happens when people get wealthy. People very, very rarely get wealthy by accident. All the research on this is really clear. People who get wealthy have a desire to store up value. They're naturally competitive with other people. They express it in different ways, but that competition and that ability to get wealthy is a self-described lifestyle choice. So understanding that's incredibly important. And that number flexes in Australia to about $1 million. It flexes again at $3 million, and it flexes even further at $7 million. The way that we started to understand this first is this test. This is the Binet-Wechsler standardized test, which was produced in 1914 for French schools. Wasn't the first IQ test. The first IQ test was done by the Americans in the Civil War to try and work out who the officers were going to be inside their army. So they did a standardized test. And in fact, now the American Army is probably the best standardized tester in the world of all these things. Some really, really interesting data in this. If you have an IQ of less than 80, which is about, give or take, 16% of the whole population, then there is no job for you. There is nothing that you can do that will actually give you a meaningful employment. So at any given time inside the population of Australia, so there's 26 million people, 11 million people working, let's say that 10% of those people, give or take a million people, they're too stupid to be employed. Now, that's a cognitive function, right? They haven't chosen to be stupid, it's just a data processing function. And that's really interesting to understand. Trust me, they're not your clients. So that's really interesting. Here's the interesting thing about you guys. To be in this room, you're to the right of this number. You're to the right of 115. So at least one decile above average, 100 being average. So you're starting to shift that, and much more likely to be two or three deciles above average. The way in which your brain functions is really different to everybody else's. And here's the really interesting thing about this. And the previous speaker spoke about Kahneman's book, Thinking and Fast and Slow. Inside your brain, Malcolm Gladwell also writes very well about this. Inside your brain, you have two systems running all the time, system one and system two. Your system one, your fast thinking, overpowers most of your system two thinking all the time. You make decisions quickly. You make what are called cognitive leaps all the time. So cognitive leaps are really interesting. They get to you to that you're right 99% of the time, but the really, really, really powerful people in this space don't make the cognitive leaps. I'm married to a woman who's I'm very lucky to be married to because she puts up with my nonsense, to be perfectly honest. But she never makes cognitive leaps. She's a tax lawyer, first class honours degree in pure maths, master's degree in tax law, understands that stuff in detail. I'll get to 90% of where we need to go on everything and just go, that's it, move on. She never does that. She can't finish a piece of work until it's finished. She will dive in deeply, deeply, deeply into the detail and everything she's doing. She'll take much longer to do things than me, but she's more likely to be right. She's a much better investor than I am because I kind of invest quickly and want to move on quite quickly as well. So you need to start to understand, are you a system one thinker or a system two thinker? What's driving what's going on? A great way of understanding system one and system two thinking is learning to drive a manual car. I don't know if any of you recently has taught a child to drive a manual car. I've taught all my children to drive manual cars. I think it's an important life skill. It has cost me two clutches, though, and one gearbox. It's important to understand that. When you're first learning to drive a manual car, you're pushing everything back to the front of your brain. It's hard, right? You're pushing it from that system one thinking into the back of your brain and embedding it into the system two. Change like that is really complex. So going through the process of identifying your cognitive weaknesses, and I think you can probably do that. I think everyone here is likely to be aware of their cognitive weaknesses. Jung was really clear about this. If you look at Jung's research on this, he said, you know what to do. The really shitty thing is doing it. And if you read Jung, he's like this. It's like having Yoda over your shoulder. He's, you know what to do. Get on with it, is basically what he says all the time. But the kind of interesting part of understanding this is that if you're going to go on the journey of making these cognitive changes about yourself and making decisions differently, then you have to accept that it's going to be hard. That's not correlated to intelligence. Everyone in this room is intelligent within probably two or three deciles of each other. That's correlated to how much pain you're prepared to put up with. Man of the Shadows, all those books, they're worth a read. Viktor Frankl, they're worth a read. But understanding that, it's really important and hard to understand. So identifying now cognitive biases about how you make snap decisions, it's a shortcut, it's a heuristic, we enjoy it. And then overcoming that is fundamentally difficult. These are the two most famous behavioral economists in the world. This is Daniel Kahneman, and the actual genius behind it was a guy called Amos Tversky. So Kahneman's alive and popular, Tversky's dead, and Kahneman's now writing with a guy called Cass Sunstein, who's a fine writer. But these are the people who made this popular. They got their Nobel Prize for behavioral economics in 1982, which is the time when I joined university, and I read it and thought this is a heartbreaking work of staggering genius. But they weren't the first thinkers on this. Herbert A. Simon got Bounded Rationality Nobel Prize in 1975. This is these two guys in 1978 having a drink. They were in Israel drinking in the sun. But this isn't a new idea. The idea in which we understand the way people work and that humans make decisions against themselves is something which is well understood. and it's something which is something that we now need to have a slightly more detailed look at. There are 180 cognitive biases which we understand and know very well. They're starting alphabetically from the ambiguity bias, which is how we act when we've got fuzzy data, to a thing called the Zeigarnik effect, which is the thing that we overvalue projects which aren't finished as compared to projects which are finished. We have this constant focus on things that are not done rather than things that are done. And we all suffer from them to various degrees. The ability to step back from that and assume and be aware of the biases that you're pushing to it is really, really uncommon in humans. Taking time to do that and understand it becomes problematic, and it becomes something which will be hard for you to do. However, as someone who's embracing this and changing this and going through the way in which I manage people, it's actually incredibly powerful. It does bring you out in a cold sweat before you go to meetings and afterwards, but it does change the way in which your organisation works. Here's the list of the things that we're most likely to suffer from. If you're here today and working in this space, here are the biases which we are all most likely to suffer from. And we all have kind of favourite biases, right? And there's a kind of couple that are worth talking about. One is the Dunning-Kruger effect. That's a pretty famous bias. This is the overconfidence bias. This is the mistake that we mistake confidence for competence. We commonly do that. It's a human shortcut. If someone's confident, they should therefore be competent. But it's not always true. The other one is the thing called the brilliant jerk bias. If someone's a problem, then they've got to be smart, right? Because they're difficult or they've got another idea. There is no evidence for that. Problem is, they're probably just a jerk. A really confident jerk. Let's combine the brilliant jerk effect with the Dunning-Kruger effect, and then we've got a really problematic employee. Generally takes about 100 days to work out whether this person is actually good at what they say they are or actually is something different. But let's understand Australia. Let's understand Australia slightly differently. I've been working on this biases and understanding it for the past 2 years. We've got a series of databases that we own and that we have complete control of. And what we focus on these databases is not thin data, which is single transactions, but thick data. The Hunter and Bligh database we own has 160,000-ish Australians in it. Grows at 200 people a day, but we've got thick data on them. We know where they live, we know what they earn, we know all those kinds of things, and we watch their behaviours online because people give us a pixel and we can track what they do. You can learn a huge amount of person by someone like that. The second part of the group that we're fascinated by is the Australian financial planners. People who form part of our database or are listed on the database, we actually have thick data on those guys as well. Most people publish their email address and that gives you the right to hoover it up. And once you've hoovered it up, you can start to look at it and start to see how people are acting and behaving. So you can start to split people out into cohorts. And then you can start to attribute success to those cohorts. Then you can start to actually look at how those cohorts are behaving in the market and know who's going to survive and who's not going to survive. One of the big pieces of work done in the past 2 years was in the UK. The UK focused RDR and MiFID II. I'm sure you know all about that and what they faced over there, where they had to move from commissions to fees. And so we did a lot of work with the regulator there and a lot of work with the firms there and watched who failed and who survived and started to unpick the biases that existed with those sorts of people. And that's the bit which gets really interesting, because trust me, we're facing into 4 years of headwinds in this industry. Regulatory change, we've got a toppy market, we've got a flaky government, for want of a better word. So there's a lot going on. So if we start to unpick the Australian market and we start to have a look at the Australian financial advisors, which is a group we know well, we can start to break them up into groups. We have foxes. These tend to be small, well-run businesses, and the thing which is most commonly correlated with them is if you go and look at their businesses, they're profitable, they understand their business, they've got a business plan, a 1 year, a 3 year, and a 5 year. They tend to be cloud-based and they tend to have a small number of partners and be based in regions where there's lots of money. It's not that unusual to say, well, that's correlated with success, but it's not. There's plenty of people who are based in regions with lots of money who aren't making money. That's not uncommon. Then we have this group called Oxes, who are much the same but slightly larger and slightly older. So they have come with more complex books of business and they have come with more complex behaviours. The most common complex behaviour inside the Ox is you get a two-speed business. You get a group of people who are principals who've been there for greater than 7 years and they're trying to take money out of the business. You get a group of people who are partners who have been there for less than 7 years and they're trying to put money back into the business. And that's creating this kind of cognitive tension inside the business. Then you get a group of people called islanders. They tend to be people who are running everything on their own. They're bobbing up and behaving very differently now. They're trying to add value as fund managers. They're trying to take control of that system and say, my ability isn't just to accumulate the data, but it's actually to be a fund manager. I'm buying research in, I'm doing et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. The regulator hates them, wants them gone and wants them destroyed because it doesn't think they can do that truly job. Some can, right? Honestly, there are people I've met who are in this space who are very good at that and should be allowed to do it, but there's plenty who aren't. And the final group are cruisers. Problem with the cruisers is they're 42% of the market by number, and they work Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. Their golf handicap tends to be single digits. They tend to rely on insurance books. Their sailing times are fantastic, and they take about 2 months holiday a year. But they charge for 200 days of work a year. So they're rent seekers, and they want them out of the market as well. So when you start to look at the cognitive biases that exist inside each of these groups, this becomes really interesting and really problematic. I've just been to the UK. All four of those groups exist in the UK. I've been to Western Germany. None of those groups exist in Western Germany. Everyone is either a fox or an ox. Their business is much less interesting and dynamic than the Australian businesses, but they are so serious about what's going on. The thing that shocked me when I sat with the financial planners in West Germany, I met with a group in Bremen, sat down, did a speech, and then met them afterwards. Each of them knew to the number of how much was being exported from West Germany. They were aware of the containers that were leaving West Germany. They were aware that the high-value goods market for them was over, and they needed to start to think differently if they were going to make money for their clients. That would be uncommon in Australia for people to know how many tons of coal we were shifting. But these guys knew, and they knew where their wealth had come from. It's kind of interesting meeting I had in Bremen. I met this guy who's phenomenally wealthy, is one of the high net worth panel that we had there, and I sort of sat down with him and said, chatting away, nice guy, spoke English well, I speak German well enough to come, and towards the end of it, he liked beer, I like beer, so we got on quite well, was sitting drinking beer, and I said, well, how did your family make money? And he said, we sold caffeine to the Nazis. Really? Yeah, yeah. So we worked how to take caffeine out of coffee beans, and we sold it to the Nazis, sold it to the fighter pilots. And you're allowed to keep it? Well, the Swiss, it's kind of interesting, right? People in West Germany made all sorts of money from all sorts of... I met the guy whose family invented the fuel tanker, but anyway. All these things are quite interesting. But understanding where you sit in this framework and where your cognitive bias wants to be is going to be really important. One of the big challenges with the people that we saw in the UK who didn't make it through the change and didn't move their business forward, they suffered from an anchoring bias which had them focused on the past. They weren't anchored on the future, but they were anchored on the past. If you're a little bit older like me, start to examine the times where you start to reflect it's not the way it was and you talk and think about the past and the way it is and understand where your anchoring is. If you're thinking on the future of your business or anchoring on the past of your business. Understanding yourself is notoriously complex and really hard. Freud talks very clearly about this and how complex it is to start to understand yourself and the pain it is. It's often impossible to do yourself. But there is a series of tools that you can use to start to unpick your biases. I've been through this process. It's really tough. It's emotionally tough. It's kind of conversationally tough. Having conversations with people that you love about it's quite interesting. But the first thing you have to do is embrace this test. It's called the Ocean Test for a very simple reason. The construct is openness, conscientiousness, extroversion, agreeableness, and neuroticism, which conveniently spells ocean. This is called the big five factors of anyone's personality. You are going to be hardwired in terms of a series of the way in which you work, and understanding that is quite interesting. I'm quite an open person. I'm not at all agreeable. I'm less than 10, in the bottom 10th percentile in the agreeableness. I'm not particularly extroverted. My extroversion is a learned behavior. I'm in the bottom 10th percentile for extroversion. I'm not particularly agreeable, but I'm not particularly neurotic. I don't stress, I don't worry, and that confuses the people I'm with and it confuses the people I work with. I never worry about things. I see something as a list of problems. I never get stressed about it. Here's the jobs to be done. What do we need to do? We need to, the world's falling apart. Okay, well, let's make a list and let's just move through the list, which is part of my conscientiousness. But that's kind of interesting. Understanding where you fit on that becomes really important. The effects of this are real. And there's so many examples in financial services that I could give you about the effect of this and how it worked. The list was too long to do without exception. So I wanted to focus on this guy. Everyone knows who this guy is, right? Bernie Madoff, greatest fraud ever perpetrated. He was the classic definition of a psychopath. Even after he was arrested and he'd stolen people's money, Remember, he didn't even try and invest it badly. He simply stole it. The whole thing was a Ponzi scheme. He didn't collect $60 billion a month, which is what about what he's collecting at the peak of his organization, just invest it in cash and some shares and underperform the index. He just spent it. It was a fraud. To me, it's kind of unbelievable that someone could do that. And then when you get arrested, he was saying, well, I want special treatment. I want to be treated specially and different. But what's really interesting about the Madoff fraud is who fell for it. Remember, this wasn't just mums and dads. This wasn't someone from Des Moines, Iowa, who's a potato farmer who decided that they wanted to invest their money with these guys. It was HSBC. I looked up who was on the board of HSBC and the investment committee at the time they were making with the investments from Bernie Madoff. These were experienced, powerful, professional people. A couple of PhDs, long term. Santander, $130 billion with Bernie. And very sophisticated investors. More interestingly, these guys. Everyone know Renaissance Capital out of New Jersey? These are the red hot best fund managers in the world. $40 billion with Bernie. All PhDs, ex-NASA. They fell for it. They fell for it because it was a confirmation bias. They couldn't get over the fact that this group of people were acting in the same way. There's also a couple of other biases. There was the People Like Us bias. Big Jewish charities and big Jewish schools had lots of money with him because he was from the New York Jewish community. But this confirmation bias that all these people had, that he had to be doing something special and different, was really interesting. And that's what drove a lot of his money. This happens a lot in financial services now. As we gather more and more data, we're actually making this mistake less. There were plenty of people who said Bernie's full of nonsense, right? But let's go back in Australian history to the not-too-distant future. Does everyone remember Storm here? A lot of people who work, not necessarily in your group, and the fact that you're here suggests that you're unlikely to do it, but a lot of people were selling a lot of products into Storm because the same reason that people sold a lot of products for Bernie, they were getting 10%. For every billion you gave them, you got 100 million. So there's a lot of people making a lot of money out of that process. At the time Storm was going on, I went to the regulator and said, this is a tier 2 capital scheme. It looks exactly like estate mortgage. This is going to go tits up. And I said, well, it's compliant. That's not the point, right? It's a tier 2 capital scheme. We've seen this before. We've seen Tricorp. We've seen estate mortgage. We've seen all of these things before. Yeah, it's compliant. And then so I thought, well, they don't have to listen to me because I'm just some schmo from Bridge Street. So I went with Paul Clitheroe, who said the same thing. And they said, it's compliant. And so we went away. I've now taken to doing something really mean to the regulator. When I see these things occurring, I email them and say to them, now you never get to say, well, I didn't know. What's happening in Australia now with this period of low returns, and returns are flat and they're going down, as we're seeing these bob up again. I'm not going to say the names of these companies, but my sense is that you know them all because I'm in trouble, right? One of these guys is suing me because I've been saying, this is bullshit, you can't do this. But they're doing it, right? But fortunately, ASIC's kind of ridden into the rescue and said, you can't do this. We're seeing this behavior again. People chasing risk to get return. They're taking out full page ads in the AFR, they've got television ads, and they're selling something which isn't true. There's people out there now sucking a lot of money into a cash trust, and if you read the PDS as I do, because remember, I'm big on conscientiousness, it says in the PDS, it may take up to 365 days to return your capital. That's not a cash trust. Sorry, ain't a cash trust. Stop marketing as a cash trust. Stop saying you're going to get 6% on this cash trust. It's not a cash trust. And if you look at this deep inside what they're investing in, they're investing in high-risk shares to throw off that return. But they're marking themselves as a cash trust. Yet both of those funds are hoovering up tens of million dollars as we speak because our bias towards the belief that if it looks good and it looks smart and it does all those things, they're starting to actually behave in that way. And you can see it, right? And it's your job to say to your clients, someone's promising you 9% in a 3% world, we don't know where they're getting the 6% from. So let's talk about the most common biases that you're going to run into when you're working with. When you're employing people, you're going to see this, the Dunning-Kruger effect, people who are far more confident than they should be. So we've got a series of tests for this now. We get people to do algorithms and write tests and go through the process with us before we do it. And we do spatial reasoning tests, and it throws off like you would not believe people who aren't who they say they are. So start to apply that to yourself and to other people and start to think about it. This one is the curse of knowledge. This is the highly educated idiot. I often think that I suffer from this. The fact that I know who Herbert Simon is doesn't mean that I understand his work particularly well. But highly educated idiots are also something that is out there and something which is, we run into frequently in this industry. The Barnum effect, we've just been describing that. the confidence trickster who lives in it, who looks good, talks good, makes the effect, but develops momentum. And once that momentum is developed, then that starts to move forward. And this, the other group, which is the in-group preference. We sell to each other, we sell to people like us, and we start to do that. I don't mind doing that as a business when it's starting to develop, but if you're truly going to get beyond that, and I think this is something that Platinum have really sort of overcome, is that you have to start to look past that and start to go further than that. But the most common one that we suffer from as investors is this one, the sunk cost fallacy. Once we start to, particularly in projects and changes in the business and the way in which you operate, once we've committed to something, because of one of the things that I was talking about before, the Zeigarnik effect, we tend to want to finish things which are really bad ideas. I'm restoring a 1985 car. I've now spent much more money on that car than that car's ever going to be worth. I can kind of logically say it because I enjoy it, right? I take pleasure from being up to my knuckles in grease and bashing them on the weekends, which is true, but it's a sunk cost. Understanding that inside our businesses, inside the products and the things and the processes that we work on is really tough, because we have a preference, because the Zeigarnik effect, to actually keep following those stupid ideas further and further down the rabbit hole. So the man in the mirror, or the woman in the mirror, the man is a kind of a, comes from the back of human rather than, it's not particularly gendered, or I don't want it to be gendered, is really interesting. All groups suffer from this differently. Women have different behavioural biases to men. People are educated at different times, have different behavioural bias. Racial groups have different behavioural biases. It's all perfectly true. A satisfaction measure of 4 in West Germany is highly satisfactory. In Australia, it means you're about to go out of business. In Australia, that number has to be 6 or better. So an NPS score of 4 in West Germany is good. There's something that you can do which is quite simple. For $9, you can go online and do Understand Myself, which is a piece of work produced out of the University of Toronto, and you can get your five-factor test, and it's pretty accurate. I did one which took a day and a half. This is a sunk cost fallacy, right? Day and a half of testing, big test, sat at the university for a day and a half, did thousands and thousands of questions, cost quite a lot because it's a day and a half and the person went through it. Then I did this one for $9.95 and the result was exactly the same. Utility, right? Sunk cost fallacy right there. It's got to be better if it's at the university, right? Turns out it's not. More interestingly, there's a short form one which you can find. So you just go online and Google short form five-factor test, which is only 9 questions. And it's within statistical tolerance of the $9.95 one, and that one's free. So understanding this is really important. So starting to look at these things and understand what's going on, and then figuring out where that fits in the business becomes important. The best thing that you can do once you understand your biases is not embark in the process of changing yourself, because that's really hard and you will find it almost impossible to do by yourself. The best thing you can do is start to apply these tests to the people around you, and get people who have different behavioural biases to you. My managing director in Australia is a guy called Jason Andreessen. The managing director in the UK and the USA is Craig Phillips. And I've chosen them because they're actually nicer people than me. They're much more agreeable, right? They bring a team along. Their first instinct isn't to tear their head off the person. It's to actually work with them to make it work. So starting to match your behavioural biases rather than change them is a very powerful thing to do. The kind of end of this is the concept that you can identify your behavioural biases, which I think is your cognitive and behavioural biases, and compensate for them. Now, this is really challenging for us as individuals because a lot of our success has been built by our biases. I've got a bias towards hard work. I just have. Got up at 5 a.m. to talk to the people in America today, and my whole family think I'm an idiot. It could well be true. I'm an idiot. I've got a phone call at 11 o'clock tonight with their UK guys. Because I get an emotional reward from working hard. I've got a bias to doing high-quality work, which is important, right? If you're going to be in research and doing those sorts of things, you want it to be really good. I don't have a bias towards presenting. I feel like I'm sweating like I'm running a marathon up here because my body finds this so hard to do. And I've got my hand in my pocket, not because I'm nervous, but because I've lost so much weight, I'm too cheap to buy another pair of suits and my trousers may fall down. And it's something you really don't want to see. I should just put another hole in my belt, but then it makes my trousers look like they're a blouse pattern or something. But anyway, that's a whole other thing. So I understand those things about myself. I've hired around them, and where I can, I compensate for them. It's not easy. But doing the hard things well is the thing which is going to change you. There's a really famous quote by Marcus Aurelius. I don't know if you read his work. He's one of the great Stoic writers. He was a Roman. And he said, the problem is the solution. And we all know this to be true. But you have to decide how much you want to do it. How much do you want to transform yourself? How much do you want to compete? How much do you want to do this? Do you want to hire around it? Do you want to change yourself? Do you want to do those things? I'm going to come back to the first thing that I talked about was that I believe in the industry that we're in. I'm one of the few people who does it. I've produced proofs to government and they've used them. This industry is transformative. If you work in this industry and you take people in, you will transform them through your actions with them. It literally de-risks the country by taking the risk from the public sector and putting it on the private sector as we go through this process. Stick with it. The next 4 years are going to be really hard. You're going to have to identify your biases and match them or transmit them as much as you can. But it will, in the end, be transformative.